Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hi everyone, this is Risky Business and I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition is brought to you by Checkpoint and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting, so thank you to both of them. This week's show is a bit of a mixed bag. We'll be checking in with 451 Group analyst Paul Roberts, who's at the RSA conference in San Francisco. And we'll also be having a chat to Adam Poynton about his adventures with X10 home automation equipment. Checkpoint Australia's engineering services manager Steve McDonald is this week's sponsor guest. But before we get into all of that, there's time for some housekeeping. So here's the weekly hassle. Please go to risky.biz and sign up for an account. That way you can contribute to our forums, discuss our content and receive our newsletter. And in the newsletter, you get a once weekly summary of all Risky Business podcasts and articles and basically everything that's appeared on the site. And if you're based in Australia or New Zealand, you'll automatically be entered into our sign-ups competition when you enter in and fill in all of your details. And you do need to fill in all of the details to be eligible. First prize is an EPC, courtesy of Kaspersky Labs. We've also got a couple of Tiki Tag RFID reader writers and some great little toolkits that Microsoft gave us. Microsoft Forefront toolkits of little screwdrivers and pliers and all that sort of stuff. Very cool. Now, we'll be announcing the winners in a few weeks, I think around the time of AusCert, which is coming up in mid-May. Oh, and Australian gaming laws mean it's illegal for me to offer this as a game of chance, so the winners will be selected for having the coolest username as judged by me and my mate's three-year-old and possibly my pet budgie. There you go, now it's a game of skill and compliant with the relevant gaming regulations. So stay tuned, guys, I should be announcing that in a few weeks, guys and gals. And don't forget to update your subscriptions. We now update mostly, primarily, first on risky.biz. And while we're keeping the old IT radio feed running for now, I will be pulling the plug soon. So, go to risky.biz, sign up for a newsletter, update your feeds, risky.biz/feeds, and voila. Anyway, now that I've gotten through all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with our very own rock star, Adam Boileau, joining us on the line this week from Christchurch, New Zealand. Adam, there's been a bit of action in your part of the world with a whole bunch of websites getting owned through their domain registrar.
Yeah, now this has been a particularly interesting event in New Zealand because the what appears to have happened is a bunch of relatively high-profile sites got defaced. It was Coca-Cola and Microsoft and F-Secure and a few other things that are fairly embarrassing for their parent companies. And they got defaced, standard Turkish script kiddie style, a picture of Bill Gates with a pie in his face, that's all good lols. But the really interesting thing for us is that it was done apparently through SQL injection in the domain registrar's website, that's pretty shocking.
Yeah, well, especially when you consider they got Windows Live, MSN, Hotmail, and MSDN.
Well, exactly. And the thing that really concerns everyone over on this side of the ditch is that the registrar that they hacked, it's our big old money registrar. Back in the old days when you could only get domain names through an ISP or a registrar, they were the only registrar selling. Anyone who registered a domain in the 90s, which is, all our banks and all the big companies, registered through this, through Domains, which is now a subsidiary of Melbourne IT. We went through the actual statistics, and it's something like about 50,000 domains are registered through them, but it's of the top 500 financial companies, by financial size companies in the country, 50% of them are registered with domains. So it's a pretty big deal for almost every large organization in New Zealand. And so far, everyone we've talked to has been extremely surprised at just how easy it was.
Yeah, well, I got to say, it's kind of lucky that it was these Turkish script kiddies. They've kind of done us a favor by exposing this, really appalling flaw. It looks like it was a SQL injection flaw on the domain's admin console, which is just...
That's what we hear, yes.
Yeah, it's just hilarious, isn't it?
What that says to me is that they never got a pen test ever.
Yeah.
And that's, that makes me worried, eh? With so much of our infrastructure depends on trustworthy DNS.
Yeah, so I guess they're the ones with pie on their face or egg on their face, as you think.
Absolutely. And the sad thing is that the mainstream media have picked it up as a Microsoft got their website defaced, and the Microsoft guys over here are like, oh, for God's sake, face palming, because it's not their fault. They registered with a reputable, local domain registrar, and what are they supposed to do?
Oh, and the funny thing is domains And that's domain with a Z on the end. Domains are actually owned by Melbourne IT, as you mentioned, but they are PCI compliant, apparently.
Well, I mean, they certainly process enough domains. You would expect them to be a level one certified merchant. So, yeah, it would be. I would certainly be interested to see what they have to say to their acquiring bank about their PCI certification after this incident.
Yeah, well, last week we had Brian Sarton on the show talking about that Verizon Business, dissection of their 2008 forensic investigations, and they said that 11% of breached merchants were actually PCI compliant versus 19% who claimed to be, but 11% were rigid-edge compliant. Now, the thing that makes me laugh about that is what percentage of merchants out there do you actually think are PCI certified to begin with? You'd think it would be around, I don't know, 11%.
Well, I suppose there is a big difference between the self-assessment level people and the people who actually have to have a person come in, who need a QSA. To come in and sign them off. And, you have to be pretty big, especially, in New Zealand, processing, a million transactions per card brand per year. I mean, that's a pretty big ask. There aren't that many level one merchants over here. So, I understand that Domains is run fairly independently from Melbourne IT. And I'm sure Melbourne IT guys are hopping mad at this point.
Mm.
So it may be that Domains in New Zealand are sufficiently small that it's not a problem. And they just, filled out the self-assessment with lots of ticks. And that was that.
Hooray. But, I mean, really, Adam, you've seen a lot of PCI stuff in the field. Do you think that, if you are PCI compliant, you're secure?
Well, I mean, of course not. But I do think that the fact that it is an issue right up to the sort of the C-suite level is a good thing. It makes them think about security. And PCI does cover off a lot of baseline stuff. One of the things I like about PCI is the scoping does say that everything is in scope unless you can demonstrate otherwise, and that does give QSA some leverage to push people about exactly what they are getting certified and what they aren't. But unfortunately, especially in a country the size of New Zealand, very few people actually require a QSA, to the extent that I think we have about three in New Zealand total.
Now, look, from that, which is a seemingly harmless incident, I mean, embarrassing but harmless, we move on to this next story, which is about potentially a very serious breach, which has since been denied by Lockheed. I think it was Lockheed who are running the Joint Strike Fighter project. But there was it was an article in the Wall Street Journal which said that computer spies broke into the Pentagon's $300 billion Joint Strike Fighter project and copied terabytes worth of sensitive information. Now, this one just doesn't ring true, because I would think that you would notice a few terabytes of your most sensitive information, leaking out of your network if you were a defense contractor.
Well, you would certainly hope so, yeah. But you're right. This story does, it doesn't quite sound quite believable. When, numbers like, terabytes of data, they sound, kind of made up for the benefit of rustling up media coverage. They don't really seem that believable. And the stories are very thin on details.
Yeah, now this is the same paper, and I believe the same journalist, who actually wrote the story about Chinese hackers infiltrating the power grid. Now, there's a lot of unnamed sources in these pieces. Now, one theory that's been put to me, and I think it's a very believable one, and it's not to put any negative light on the journalist or anything like that. That's not what I'm trying to do here. But it has been suggested to me that perhaps this journalist has been misled by some fairly high-profile and reputable people. Because in the United States at the moment, they're really deciding how they want to handle cybersecurity from a national point of view. So you've got the NSA and Department of Homeland Security, or elements within the within the Department of Homeland Security and elements within the NSA that are jostling to get a bigger piece of the budget and more control. So this looks to me like a bit of political posturing.
It does feel a bit like that, doesn't it? I mean, it sort of feels like, we're looking for the cyber 9/11 to, change the funding around and give us, the resources that we're looking for to, do whatever their sinister agendas are. The stories just don't seem that believable to me. I don't doubt that plenty of defense contractors get owned. We've seen that, through, the last 25 years worth of Hagbard and Pengo and, all the way through to modern stuff. So, I'm sure people do get on, but, stealing plans for strike fighters and, terabytes of data, as Schneier would say, a bit movie plot threat.
Yeah. Well, look, one thing that occurred to me, which, as an Australian, I think we could find the upside to this, because we are paying an absolute fortune to be a part of the Joint Strike Fighter project. They're not even going to give us access to the source code for these planes when they're done, and they are basically flying computers. So I reckon if the Chinese have stolen the plans to them, do you reckon they're going to start making knockoffs that we can buy cheaply?
Well, worst case, you could just go to the Pirate Bay and torrent in the source, right?
Yeah, well, we could buy a pirated joint strike fighter and save ourselves heaps of taxpayer money.
Yeah, or maybe you could buy, like, we've got some old Skyhawks over here you could retrofit maybe with the code from the joint strike fighter, and yeah, that would be pretty sweet.
That could be fun. Moving on now, and look, this is more of the same political manoeuvring. We've got Robert Gates, who's the Defense Secretary in the United States, saying the US is under cyber attack virtually all of the time, every day, and the Defense Department plans to more than quadruple the number of cyber experts it employs to ward off such attacks. So this is another case of someone from the defense sector on the government side saying, this is very serious, and we're gonna save the day. So again, it's just a reiteration of the joint strike fighter thing, but with the defense secretary jumping on the bandwagon and saying, yeah, this is bad, and you know, we can solve it.
Well, I guess they're all vying and jockeying for position, and if they can get coverage on what, 60 Minutes, they're plotting on now. Yeah, the article said that they're planning an interview for an upcoming edition of 60 Minutes. And you know when they're pushing it out into the mainstream media like that, that they're up to something political. It's not just about what's actually going on.
Well, interestingly enough, the NSA, the head of the NSA, I can't remember his name. I'm not American, so I don't know. The head of the NSA recently came out and actually stated that they didn't want the responsibility for the nation's cyber defenses. So God knows which elements of which agencies are all spreading this stuff out there. But it does seem like, you know, the very people charged with securing national infrastructure are actually engaging in a bit of FUD peddling just to secure the almighty government dollar.
Well, you know, so I guess sometimes you got to do what you got to do, right?
Now, look at this next piece, which is more our bread and butter territory. We're done talking geopolitics for the moment, but F-Secure has basically advised everyone out there in userland to stop using Adobe Acrobat Reader. Now, that's, that's a pretty bold statement coming from an established vendor.
Well, I think it's pretty funny, and it's kind of nice, I suppose, that F-Secure feel that they can actually come out and say that, and not worry about the fallout, because I'm sure Adobe are well pissed. But, you know, the numbers back them up. Was it like 40-something percent, was it they saying, of the targeted attacks using Acrobat?
Yeah, there's an absolutely god-awful amount. What do we got here? In 2008, the favored targeted attack vector was Microsoft Word. This story comes via news.com, written by Eleanor Mills, by the way. The favored attack vector was Microsoft Word, which had 15 known vulnerabilities compared to Acrobat's 19, and which represented 34% of the attacks, compared to 28.6% for Adobe Reader. Now, you know, I think it's more practical to be able to not use Adobe's PDF reader as opposed to not using Word. I think that might be where this advice is, you know, rooted in. I mean, really, you shouldn't, a PDF reader shouldn't be ownable, should it? I mean, it's fairly simple stuff.
Well, I mean, that's part of the whole point of PDF as a format, was that it was meant to be a, you know, not active, relatively safe, portable document format. It's not meant to be a word processing feature rich, let's have macros in it, but I mean, necessarily, I guess, to keep it fresh and hip, Adobe keep adding, you know, crazy new features, and you know, now look at where we are.
Now this next story makes me smile. It makes me giggle a little bit like a schoolgirl, because recently I wrote a story predicting that we would see Rigidage genuine bona fide malware affecting Macs, because we've had the vulnerabilities for a long time, but not the malware. And of course, I had the usual people, you know, sort of writing me emails, threatening to blow me up, saying Apple is perfect, Jobs is the savior, et cetera, et cetera. But it looks like we've got a Mac botnet out there in action.
You know that, like, that daring, flaming fireball guy, he's going to be blaming you for this now. It's going to be your botnet.
Yeah, totally. It was Patrick Gray who said it was going to happen, and he gave people ideas.
Damn, feeding the filthy, filthy ideas.
Yeah, so what do you think about this? I mean, this is a pretty significant development, I would have thought.
Well, I mean, I guess it's nice to see that, you know, Macs are no different to anyone else and that they get botnets. I suppose I wonder what sort of, you know, hip, bearded, turtleneck-wearing botnet author sat down and decided to, you know, to write the botnet for it.
Yeah, so is it going to be a groovier botnet than a PC one?
Well, I'm sure the management interface is way cooler.
Yeah, exactly. It's got a better GUI. But, it's been coming in bogus copies of iWork 09 and Adobe Photoshop CS4. Now, I think this is the same malware that was being tracked. God, I can't even remember the name of the company, but I had a bit of a look at it as well. And it's also been coming in through false flash updates and all sorts of things. So people, you know, they're actually out there working on it now. And I think as time goes on, I think these guys might enjoy a little bit more success in Apple land than they would have thought, because no one in Apple land is used to being suspicious of every single file that winds up on their computer, and they don't run antivirus.
Yes, well, exactly. I think it's a platform that is ripe for the plucking. I'm sure it'll be a while before we see, you know, Conflicker style, you know, millions and millions of node botnets. But, you know, as market share goes up and, as you say, no antivirus and the lack of suspicion that Windows users are now, you know, getting used to, you know, it's perfect storm time.
Yeah, well, I would have thought, I mean, the other thing about the market share argument, which I find interesting, is I have no doubt in my mind that one of the reasons Apple has made up market share in recent years is because Apple users haven't had to deal with all of the viruses and stuff that affect PCs. So, you know, if those same issues start affecting Apple, that could actually cause them some pretty tangible business problems.
Well, yeah, it will be interesting to see whether you know, this sort of thing does have any real effect, or whether, you know, Mac bigotry and fanboyism is so well ingrained that they won't notice.
Mm-mm. Now, look, in our final piece, and I just reckon this is the most awesome security story I've seen in ages. It actually came out of a newspaper. I can't remember whether it was Fairfax or News Limited, but the owners of a Long Island exotic car dealership that sells Bentleys and Aston Martins were charged with corporate espionage against a rival that sells Ferraris and Maseratis.
So, yeah, you know, you've got to feel sorry in these rough economic times, you know, for the luxury car dealers struggling to sell their, you know, multi-million dollar Enzos.
Yeah, well, you know, in desperate times call for desperate measures, and the defendants accessed Ferrari Maserati's email server about 2,500 times between February and September last year from their homes or their actual dealership. So pretty interesting stuff. So,
if you read a bit further in the article, it does say that the guys who run this Aston Martin dealership used to be the guys who ran the Ferrari dealership and indeed set up their mail infrastructure. So they obviously had the access already and just continued to use it.
Well, that's what's been alleged. And, I mean, I suppose if you're looking at an email conversation going between some millionaire who's thinking about buying a Ferrari, you might want to say, man, you know, Ferraris, you know, why buy a Ferrari like everyone else? Why not get an Aston Martin, you know, go for the British power over the Italian power?
Well, I guess they got caught now, so maybe they should, you know, learn to be a little bit more sneaky.
Okay, Adam Barlow, thank you very much for speaking to us this week.
Thanks very much, Pat.
Adam Barlow there with a look at the week's news. Coming up next, it's time for a look at what's been going on at the RSA conference in San Francisco. 2 years ago, the RSA conference was all about NAC. Or was that 3 years ago? I don't know. But, you know, it really set the stage for everyone to be talking about NAC. Well, yeah, everyone's using that now. Last year it was all about DLP, and DLP, you know, became such a big issue in 2008. So we thought we'd get on the line with someone who was there. So we rang up Paul Roberts, who used to write for IDG, but now he works for the 451 Group as an analyst. And we asked him what's been shaking over there in San Francisco. Is there an overall theme like DLP was last year?
At each RSA, you know, there are kind of two levels that the conference operates at. One is the kind of what's getting buzz, what's getting hype, where are the new companies targeting their products or services, and then there's the long tail of RSA, or the meat of RSA, which is, you know, all the vendors and all the technologies that companies are investing in, have been investing in for years, and continue to invest in. So this year, you know, and in the past, it's right. It's data leak was maybe last year, and going back a few years, maybe it was technologies like network access control or wireless security. This year, certainly concerns around cloud deployments and you know, what the implications are of you know, moving to cloud computing for security. So how do you secure data? How do you secure access?
Well, wasn't the whole point of cloud infrastructure the idea that the customers didn't have to really worry about the security anymore? It seems kind of funny that they're all like, well, we're going to talk about security in the cloud when, you know, the whole point of the cloud is that you don't, you know, the security of the cloud is handled, it's opaque, you don't have to worry about it.
I think that is the advantage for customers who might be looking at moving to that model, but of course the providers still have to worry about it. In fact, they need to worry about it more than any individual enterprise, let's say, would have to worry about, because, you know, if they're aggregating data, you know, applications that are being served to, you know, tens or hundreds or thousands of individual companies, and they become richer, fatter targets. And, you know, there's still early days for this stuff, but I mean, I think that there's been a little bit of magical thinking around the cloud that, you know, just by pushing it to, you know, a virtualized Windows server, you know, in a hosted environment, that somehow, you know, the problems inherent in Windows server go away, and obviously they don't. They're still there. It's just a different deployment model.
In terms of some of the better ideas that you've seen come out of the conference and some of the new ideas that are being discussed, what's sort of popping up on the agenda?
In terms of, you know, kind of new ideas, I'd say that there aren't many new ideas in the security business, like in most areas of human endeavor, but I'd say there are definitely shifts in focus and shifts in concern. And I think one that really stands out, and you know, I think you are hearing this from many of the keynote presenters, is a need to, you know, shift away from let's take endpoint protection, shift away from an endpoint protect model that is based on, you know, reactive technology, signature-based detection, and a need to, you know, have visibility lower down on the endpoint, you know, not just looking for malicious programs and their behavior, but really responding to some of the newer threat vectors, you know, malicious code that masks itself as a legitimate application, malicious code that, you know, encrypts its traffic in and out of infected hosts and avoids detection that way. Malicious code, maybe even that works, down at the BIOS level. And not only being able to spot this, but also being able to understand the full impact of an infection, you know, what's been touched, and what's been taken in many cases. So, you know, I've spoken to a number of companies who are circling around the problem. Where I'm hearing a lot, obviously, about hosted security deployments as an alternative for companies that are dealing with a very complicated infrastructure, on-premises infrastructure, or many different point products, looking for ways to go to lower-cost, managed or hosted offerings to take some of that off their shoulders and focus on what's important for their company. Web security as a service is something that has come up, you know, within the last 2 or 3 years, and I'd say at this show is getting a lot of attention. Certainly attention from larger vendors. And, you know, other applications for the hosted model, you know, security information management, GRC, hosted GRC seems to be things that people are saying, yeah, this could be another type of function that could move from on-prem into the cloud in one way or another.
Well, it's interesting because the impression that I'm getting from you, Paul, is that this year there isn't some one particular theme that's resonating, because last year it really was the RSA conference that put DLP on the agenda, and it certainly stayed there for the remainder of the calendar year. So you'd say probably in this instance, in this case, the RSA conference has been more of the same, talking about the latest evolution in things, but not necessarily, there's been no new amazing technology to debut or anything like that.
That's a good point. I mean, there's no silver bullet this year, and I think that's a very, I think that's true. And I think the reason for that is that there are a couple of things. We've seen several silver bullets before, and I think there's an awareness, kind of a grim awareness that they don't really ever solve all your problems. And second of all, there are just so many different problems that companies are dealing with. You know, obviously, compliance is a huge issue for companies, enterprises, particularly globally, but in North America with the Obama administration and some of the stuff that's coming and due to come out of Washington, D.C., you know, compliance is really going to be much even higher profile now than it has been in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. And it's been extremely high profile in the last 5 or 10 years, but it's going to get even hairier for companies. And that's not a silver bullet type of a problem. It's a complex problem with a lot of moving parts and a lot of different types of investments companies need to make, whether it's in behavior, you know, activity monitoring, whether it's in full disk encryption or database monitoring or what have you. Threat vectors have changed as well, and so you know, there's a reaction to that. But there are a lot of different things that are going on, and I don't think it's reducible to any one technology to say, aha, if everybody just had data leak detection, then somehow, you know, the world would be a better place.
So I guess this year it's all about taking care of the million little things that always bug us instead of trying to go for a radically new approach.
I think it's trying to take care of what really matters for enterprises, and what really matters by and large are things either that pose a kind of existential risk to your company, so intellectual property theft, data theft, or reputational risk to your company. Those are extremely important. Or things that auditors with clipboards are kind of tapping their pencil and saying, yeah, what, you know, tell me what you're doing about this particular problem. You know, tell me what you're doing, you know, to identify, you know, where all your sensitive information is, where all your personal identifiable information is, and how you're going about securing that. So, you know, those are what companies are focused on, and I think the approach that they want to take is a pragmatic one.
Okay, well, Paul Roberts, thank you very much for giving us an update on what's going on at RSA from the conference floor.
I hope this has been helpful.
Paul Roberts on the line from the RSA conference floor in San Francisco there. Next up, we're taking a look at something a bit silly, X10. Now, X10 is the protocol for home automation equipment, and apparently security wasn't a major consideration when it was designed. Now, regular guest Adam Poynton, who, as we know, is the chief security officer for a publicly listed finance company down there in Melbourne, he recently moved house, and when he moved, he bought a stack of home automation equipment before realizing that unless you live on a fairly massive estate, home automation kit is pretty pointless. So there he was with his X10 kit, and he did what any other listener would have done, and just started messing with it. And as you'll hear, X10 equipment has the equivalent security of cordless phones from the 80s. I mean, it is non-existent.
Basically, home automation standards, there's a few. One of the most predominant ones is X10. There's another one called Insteon, which is basically a newer version of X10. People use it to turn things on and off around the home. Lights, heaters, you know, draw blinds, whatever you want to turn on or off around the home. You can do it from your PC or leave it as an automated program, and away you go.
Now, I understand you recently moved into a new place and you were like, yeah, I'm going to set up X10 and I'm going to automate everything. And now you're like, you don't really have anything to automate, do you?
Yeah, well, I've always had, you know, plenty of PCs and racks and cameras and, you know, SMS gateways for alerts, intruder, things like that. But, yeah, wanted to turn some lights on and off and thought, yeah, home automation, awesome. I'll go buy some kit, rig it up, see what it looks like. And then I kind of fell short of what to do with it.
He's like, how does this make my life better?
That's right. You read the spiel on the web and it's like, you're always fumbling for the light switch. And I was like, well, no, not really.
So it's maybe for people who are a little, what is it, a couple of beers short of a six-pack or however you'd want to put it. But the interesting thing is you did actually get a chance to play with some of this kit and you found that it's not necessarily what we would call robust from a security point of view.
No, well, it's sort of it's based around using the home automation that goes on existing wired properties. If you're wiring your own house, you can run dedicated wire, and it's a lot better. But if you're sort of fitting out an existing property or home, the standard is to use over the power, sort of like think of it as reserved bits in the power signal. So you're therefore using the power grid to signal across to devices that are running on each power switch or integrated into it to turn the appliance or device on or off. But there's no security built in, really. It's just kind of, you know, the Insteon is a little bit better. It has got some sort of protection, but it's basically A to K, I think, and 0 to 9, and you just basically toggle, all right, I'm on house A and my device is number, you know, 6, and then you send the A6 on or off or dim up or dim down signal across the wires, and there you go. But the main sort of the funniest thing that I found is, okay, so I've got some home automation, okay, that bleeds across the power grid, okay, it bleeds into my neighbor's house or bleeds around wherever, and they bleed into your house too, and you know, understand that. So you can buy this, you know, X10 firewall, which is basically a closed circuit, about $400, you know, get a Sparky to install it. So I spoke to the guy, the reseller of it, and I said, oh, so how many of these do you sell? And he said, none.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like an extra $400. Well, who'd want to mess with our home automation gear. It's like, meanwhile, they don't know that you're their next door neighbor. So what sort of stuff could you actually do if, I mean, I'm taking from what you're saying that because it's over the power lines, you can pretty easily pwn your neighbor's home automation stuff.
Well, where it bleeds is a bit of an unknown, so it's kind of, I wouldn't really call it a targeted attack. It's more like the old tactical nuke. You know, you kind of shoot it out across the wires and hope that it goes in the right direction. But what I've found is that not many of my neighbours are using X10. But not any of my neighbours where my signal is bleeding. But
not that you've been looking or anything.
No. Or mate, perhaps they've got X10 firewalls, I'm not sure.
So really, the security just boils down to, like, you put it on a letter. So it's like cordless phone security from 1989 sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not quite that bad. You've got a couple of... I mean, you've got, what, 80K, whereas cordless phones would be over radio or decked or Wi-Fi now. But, you know, over radio, so you had 4 or 6 different bands that you could select from. But obviously anybody could tune in with an AM radio, FM radio with those, whereas this is a bit different.
But can you actually sniff off the wire what they're using? I mean, do you get, like, packets leaking across the wire and stuff, and you can actually see, oh, you know, Thingo just turned his oven on?
Not really, no. I mean, you can look for X10 signals across the network, network, which is the grid, but devices don't leak information like that. It's not like a Mac sitting there saying, hey, I'm here, hey, I'm here. It's more a case of on or off, or receiving or sending an on or off. There's also the wireless. There's a wireless component of it where you can send on or off signals across the wire, across the airwaves. And again, that's a reserve protocol, reserve space.
Yeah, so now I imagine at the moment, because home automation stuff, I mean, as you said, you live in it's a 3-bedroom sort of house, and really, what are you going to automate for that sort of thing? But I imagine there will be more and more applications coming along that use this X10 sort of stuff. So do you think this is the sort of stuff that we really need to bother with locking down? Or is it something where we can sort of let it slide, and if our lights start going on and off, then we should put a firewall in?
I think a lot of people obviously let it slide. I mean, you're not using this for critical infrastructure. You know, I don't see this deployed in the skater field.
Well, this actually sounds a lot more secure than most skater deployments, man. But you know,
it's through obscurity, this one for sure. Whereas skater, they treat it a little bit more seriously than this. But I think it is. It will grow a little bit. GFC sort of factored in. But I was flipped through a magazine today actually that I received in the mail. And they're doing little Linux boxes that are little appliances, like a Linksys router that does home automation, because people can just plug it into their existing systems, and you know, they basically replace a power board with a smart power board, and you can turn the devices on or off. I think it will grow, but again, you know, who's actually going to use it for what? I'm not really sure. One cool thing that I see is useful, and which is what I'm sort of focusing on, apart from the security and video footage and things like that, is the when you're away. So you travel a lot, Patrick, so you know, when you're away from home, it might be nice if it looked at the last 6 months of your behavior on a Wednesday afternoon or Monday at this time, and turned whatever lights on if you were actually at home. So somebody outside monitoring your place, hey, is he home or not, bathroom light turns on, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, whatever time you get up, and it looks like you're home, but you're not.
Well, my idea is, like, in 10 years, when there's a whole new area, a whole new subdivision that's been done and everything's wired up for X10, is you could actually sit up on top of the hill and you could code it up so that you could play Tetris with the lights in people's houses. I think that would be probably about as beneficial or about as much fun that you could have with an X10 hack. And I guess this is my point, is that does anyone really stand to gain anything by owning someone's X10 deployment? I mean, is it the sort of thing where you can open up their garage door and steal their car? I mean, is this something that thieves are going to get interested in? Because I can't imagine too many quote-unquote, you know, computer criminals are going to really get into this stuff.
They probably wouldn't use X10 for things like that, but I've heard a lot of people talking about interest in, you know, you're at work and a sparky or somebody needs to come in and, you know, polish your floors or clean your house or whatever, and they buzz on the door and you get something on your phone and you look at the camera on the phone, you say, yeah, it's Fred, he's in to polish the floors, so I'll, you know, remotely open my doors and he will then be able to open these doors and these lights and these PowerPoints will come on for him and things like that, and then when he leaves it'll lock the door. So people will rig up their houses to automate that process device and allow remote access to it, of course, which will be fun. But I don't think X10 will really be used for that because it's more of an aftermarket thing rather than a built-into new homes. The built-into the new home stuff will be more secure because it, well, unless, you know, we go the way of IPv6 and everything, your fridge is online, then there'll be problems. But I don't think where we're at now, it's really a major problem. I'm sure people are hooking them up to stupid things like, you know, their garage systems and not that they're stupid, but security, using them for security, access control, things like that. But I haven't seen a lot of that in what I've read in forums and seeing how people are using it to see how it's actually being adopted.
So basically what you're saying is if your lights start switching on and off uncontrollably, maybe it's time to splash out $400 on an X10 firewall, and if not, don't worry about it.
Yeah, exactly, X10 firewall. And I asked the guy and I said, well, does this stop it bleeding in and bleeding out? And he said, well, I'm not really sure. I know it stops it bleeding out, and my interests are more about it bleeding in. So, yeah, we'll see.
Hooray for X10. All right, Adam Poynton, thanks a lot for your time.
No worries, mate.
Adam Poynton there, speaking to me over a beer at the Retreat Hotel in Brunswick, Melbourne, which is a very good spot. Now, look, it's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Steve McDonald from Checkpoint Software, who have been a fabulous sponsor and supported us for, a couple of years now. So they've been really, really good to us. Now, there's been borderline hysteria in the Australian press lately, and indeed in the US press, about the threat China poses to our wonderful democratic ways, including, of course, Chinese state-sponsored cyber threats. So it looks like the government is shaking things up in little old Australia. We've even got our first National Security Chief Information Officer, a Defence Signals Directorate officer named Rachel Noble. Now, Steve joined me to discuss the latest developments and what they may mean for the Australian industry.
So yeah, there's certainly a big position by the government to look at centralising a lot of the control over e-security in Australia, and certainly a lot more focus in the mainstream media, you said, about some reporting of specific countries and the perceived threat to both government and commercial interests in Australia and outside of Australia.
This threat, I mean, there's no doubt that there is some sort of legitimate threat from state-sponsored hacking and all of that, and, you know, targeted IP theft and all of that sort of stuff. But I get the impression that, you know, just with what we've seen in the US and with what we've seen here, it seems people are really using China as the most public example of the threat. So they're really pointing at China and saying, we need to protect ourselves because these guys are after us. Now, it does seem to have got a bit overkill, doesn't it?
Yeah, particularly when you look at China as a very strong trading partner to Australia. The threat there is interesting, but you go back in time and look at situations between Russia and America with certain levels of industrial espionage and state-sponsored espionage in the past. So there's nothing new in all of this, but I think the government is certainly taking the right steps and starting to centralise some of the management functions and some of the control over e-security. Because right now, you know, we've got departments ranging from ASIO, DSD, and various other government departments all doing their own individual thing. We'd hope that they could work together a lot more effectively. Whether they can or can't, that'll be proven.
Yeah, because we haven't really had a big restructure to deal with, you know, quote-unquote modern threats, have we? DSD has traditionally been responsible for providing guidelines to government departments on securing information and providing incident response services. And, you know, the Attorney General's Department has GovCert, and you've got AusCert, which is, you know, sort of the self-appointed cert for the country, which is really, curiously, a registered business name of the University of Queensland. So it does seem, and it's not, I'm not trying to say anything bad about the work of all of these departments, but it does seem, from a management point of view, to be a little bit ad hoc, doesn't it?
There's no question about that. And the argument could be made, are these government departments and non-government departments supposed to work with each other? Are they currently designed to do so? And what can we do in the future? Looking at DSD, we have a lot to do with them and with our product certifications. And over the last 2 years, we've noticed an absolute fundamental shift in their level of service and what they do and their willingness to help. So we're really seeing some big changes already. And whether or not we can end at one amalgamated sort of control or management capability, that will be interesting to see.
I remember about 8 years ago, I actually tried to ring the Defence Signals Department and I got an answering machine.
Well, I just had to, 2 weeks ago, post some changes to DSC EPL listing for the main products, and I sent an email, and within 4 hours I had an email response from a human, an individual, with a reference number and contact details. It's a vastly different situation.
I was going to say, did you fall off your chair?
No, because it did happen once before. So once again, those guys need to be applauded, and I'm not trying to suck up to them too much, but obviously
yes,
big changes. Well, I am. What am I saying? But
What are some of the specific changes? I understand that there's a woman who's been appointed, like the first government CISO or something like that. What's that all about?
So yes, certainly we do have a new appointee there reporting in to Duncan Lewis, who is the National Security Advisor. So that's some management changes and some start of the process, but that's one step, and I'm sure there are many to come, and specifically stepping up a new government department or a new organisation within government is going to take a long time, and it will take quite a bit of effort to achieve. And we'd hope that they will be open to lobbying from obviously security industry vendors within Australia to look at what we can do better here. But fundamentally, I think the other angle on this is a lot of our customers are seeking guidance. Currently, they probably don't get as much guidance as they might like from government on various topics.
You're talking about private sector clients.
Yeah, private sector clients, whether it's a banking and finance industry or whether it's various other industries. But they could certainly be getting a lot more assistance from government in terms of top-level controls, a lot more information pushed down, and a lot more, not regulation, but certainly a lot more information sharing.
So at the moment, we've got like the shared standard, which is ACSI 33, which no one really... Well, I mean, some people in the private sector used to use it, but it's not overwhelmingly popular anymore. So you'd like to see the government actually take more of a role in helping to coordinate strategies, share information, that sort of stuff.
Well, if we're talking about state-sponsored espionage, there's no choice. The government has to step in and help because the private sector simply cannot provide that kind of resource or that kind of investment to step up and protect against that kind of threat. So by centralising all that control and hopefully some of the budgets and the efforts, I'm sure there's room there for the private sector to get a lot of added benefit.
But do you think this could really actually make any sort of tangible difference to the level of security out there among, you know, corporates? Do you think that's actually doable? Just by setting up a new government department and a new management structure?
Maybe it's more about awareness and making sure that people are aware of what the risk could be and possibly being aware of if they are under attack. Maybe not so much about the protection, because that will require, obviously, investment to be made and security levels to be stepped up. And in most corporate environments, that could, in effect, disable the business. So to get to that level of security. So it's probably more awareness and assistance to handling any incidents, particularly if we are talking about foreign state powers looking to attack specific companies for specific outcomes.
I suppose it's no surprise that the government is looking to do this stuff, given, you know, recent government probes that have been made public have found some pretty scary stuff. I don't know if the federal government's done the same thing. I mean, they almost certainly have, but the Western Australian government recently did a bit of a review into its own security of looking at 65 departments, five of them very seriously. And the findings were a little bit frightening, weren't they?
Yeah, look, certainly this will be a good example of what the government might be hoping to achieve, and given information loss over the years and stories of USB keys washing up in various locations. And that's an interesting side of it. But this situation with one government department or a series of agencies where the Auditor General in Western Australia was quoted as saying, "I found fundamental weakness in all of the key areas of information security at the agencies examined." And we're not talking about very advanced threats. We're talking about the simple things. We're talking about password complexity. We're talking about old accounts not being deleted. We're talking about lack of IT security policies and implementations, the basic things that we all know that we should be doing.
Yeah, like patching. I mean, they even said that stuff wasn't getting patched. Information was being stored in databases with no passwords. Default passwords were being used. I mean, this is pretty incompetent stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a level of competency here which is missing. And
always the diplomat, Steve.
It'd be nice to think that any future steps forward in e-security and centralised control at a federal level will help us with these kind of situations. And certainly this issue wouldn't just be confined to government. There is certainly in the private sector, these kind of things would not be the rarity in a lot of organisations throughout Australia and New Zealand.
All right, Steve McDonald, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Steve McDonald from Checkpoint there in this week's sponsor interview. Now it's time for a check of this week's audio mailbag. And last week we asked the question, what's the biggest pain in your ass? Now, Martin phoned in with this response and a warning, the phone quality here isn't the best, but the content is certainly good. So here's Martin.
You're asking what keeps me up at night? What's the pain in my ass? Number one, it's got to be just prioritizing. There's so many things that we have to do and so few resources to get them all done. You've got to figure out what's going to kill me, and then once we fix those things, what can hurt me? It sucks, but it's real, and that's life these days. Take care.
And there you go. This week's question, I'd like to ask you about your experience with DLP. It got really hyped up at the last RSA conference, so it's been around a year since it's been on the mainstream IT agenda. Have you been forced to install it by brainwashed management drones? Have you actually pushed through a DLP project yourself? What's your experience been? Has it been positive? Has it been negative? Call us, Sydney 02-8569 1835, or USA toll-free 877-688-8417. Apologies for having such a late show this week. And that's it for this week's show. This next song's going out to someone who knows who they are. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Got to get you out of my head. Everywhere I go, you are there. So I'll be blunt and I'll be brief. Quite frankly, dear Heinrich, we don't need the grief.